And this is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Good morning, and welcome back to hour number two of the show. In this part of the program, we'll be talking about the relative importance of race and class in America. And we'll also be talking about a program known as A Better Chance. A Better Chance was founded in 1963, and its purpose was to help minority kids succeed in school. But unlike programs that provided, for example, tutoring after school or during the summer, the ABC program took students away from their local schools and their homes and placed them in some of the most exclusive prep schools in the country. In the heyday of this program, in the years 1964 to 75, more than 100 schools across the country were participating. By 1983, when the ABC program marked its 20th year, more than 5,000 students had passed through it. 99% of the ABC graduates went on to college, attending some of the nation's top universities. Our guest this morning has done a study of the ABC program, looking at how the program affected the lives of those who took part in it and how well they have done as adults, and also looking at this larger question of the relative importance of race and class in the United States. Our guest for the program this morning is Richard Zweigenhaft. He is a professor of psychology at Guilford College, which is in Greensboro, North Carolina, and he is the co-author, along with G. William Domoff from University of California at Santa Cruz, co-author of a book examining the ABC program. The book is entitled Blacks in the White Establishment, A Study of Race and Class in America, and it's published by the Yale University Press. As we talk this morning our guest, Professor Zweigenhaft, you are certainly welcome to call in. Maybe you'll have some questions or comments as we continue through the topic. If so, please do pick up the telephone and call. Our number here is, local number, is 333-9455. Or 333-WILL, they're both the same. That's for the local listeners here, but we do also have a toll-free line, and that makes it a free call if you're outside of the immediate area, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Professor Zweigenhaft, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
I'm glad to do it.
I suppose we ought to talk first a little bit more about the ABC program, how it came about, and what those people who set it up were hoping to accomplish.
Sure. It was actually a response to the civil rights movement, obviously, that had taken place in the early 60s. A group of headmasters realized that it was time for their schools to integrate. In some cases, they realized that it was time for their schools to do a better job of integrating if they already had black students. And so they got together, got some grant money, and set up this program, which was designed first to find capable minority students. It was not just for black students, though 70% of the participants were, over the years, black. And secondly, to prepare them to go to prep schools. That preparation turned out to entail an 8-week orientation session, first at Dartmouth, and then they held some at some other colleges in New England. One was held at Carleton College in Minnesota a couple years after the program got rolling. And within a couple of years, they also had secured some money through a major grant from the Office of Economic Opportunity, and therefore by about 66, 67, they were sending hundreds of students to various prep schools, mostly in New England, but increasingly all over the country as the prep schools signed up to participate. Let me stress that some of these schools had integrated long before, Andover, Mount Hermon being examples, but many of these schools had only very recently integrated or hadn't yet integrated, and so the pressure was on. They were embarrassed at being lily white. They were getting pressure from their students. They were getting pressure from some of their alumni, though some of their alumni were also resistant to the idea. Mm-hmm. So it very much was a part of the civil rights movement.
We have here in this program a bringing together of two groups of students with very different backgrounds, very different experiences, and many of them that previously had little or no experience with the other. I recall one of the women that you interviewed, a black woman who had been part of this program, said that one of the first white students that she had met at the prep school that she had gone to said the only black person she had ever known previously was their maid.
Right.
And you know, and it seems here that we have the possibilities for great misunderstanding and tension and friction as here these two very different groups of people get used to each other, try to get to know each other, and really end up living each other.
Right. You're absolutely right. It was actually more than two different groups because the ABC program was seeking out minorities from a number of different backgrounds. As I said, most were black, but they also included American Indians and Chicanos and Puerto Ricans. But you're right that the main division was one of class. The upper class, the students in most of these schools were predominantly upper class or upper middle class. The students coming into the program were all from economically impoverished backgrounds. I think the ABC program did a better job of preparing its students for going to the prep schools, and that summer session I mentioned was central to that preparation, than the prep schools did in preparing their students for the arrival of these newcomers. That took place over time, and that varied from school to school. But I don't think there was a comparable orientation at the prep school level, and in some cases that led to problems. I must say, however, despite that example that you gave, which was one of many horrifying stories or anecdotes that I was told, I went into the study expecting there to have been more friction between the two sets of students we're talking about, and was surprised, pleasantly surprised, that there was less than I expected, and in fact some genuine friendships were formed, lifetime friendships were formed. I think the students, by and large, being aware young people in 1963, 65, 67, they too were interested in their schools integrating, and I think they were, and many of them were, willing to welcome people from a different background. Mm-hmm. There were aberrations and there were clearly some problems. But the people I interviewed had fonder memories of their prep school experience than I expected when I went into the study.
Obviously, the kids who were selected to go into this program must have been selected with the thought that they could make it academically in this environment. And you know, I don't know what sort of perceptions people have about prep schools, but it is a very rigorous academic environment. It's no clear sail simply because one is wealthy and comes from a privileged background.
So I
suppose the question is, competing in this very highly charged, very competitive academic atmosphere, how did the ABC kids do?
Yeah, it's a good question. They were carefully selected, and in fact they were selected not only for their academic potential, but based on evaluations of their personality, character, temperament, in terms of whether those making the judgments thought that they could survive in such a different kind of an environment. Many of them told me that when they first arrived in prep school, even after this rigorous summer transition program, which focused in part on academic preparation, that they were way behind their classmates. That some of them who had never gotten anything less than an A were getting C's or D's. It was a very difficult transition for some, though for some others, they did well pretty much early on. Within about a year, they were catching up, and by the time they graduated, the ABC students were performing comparably to their much more privileged classmates. Now, I think that in itself is a striking finding, because many of these prep schools, as you say, are not only academically rigorous, but are quite selective themselves on using academic criteria. So the fact that these students from backgrounds that were, as I said, economically impoverished, and in some cases from schools that were not very good schools academically, the fact that they did as well as they did was striking, and it was certainly noticed by the colleges when they applied to colleges 2 or 3 or 4 years after arriving at the prep schools, because they were accepted at very fine colleges. They moved onto a fast track academically.
What percentage of the ABCD students did not complete the program? And in those cases, do you think it was because they were having a difficult time academically, or because, in a sense, the situation that they were being put in was so difficult that they just couldn't deal with it?
Yeah. I asked the people I interviewed that very question. I don't know the exact percentage. It was not a big percentage at the outset. The program changed and the times changed over the years. So I think, for instance, by about 1970 or 72, it was a higher percentage dropping out of the program than it had been in 65 or 66. But that was also true for white students at those prep schools at that time. To go to the second part of your question, people left for a variety of reasons. Some got there and just didn't like it. They missed their friends, they missed their families, they didn't feel comfortable in the rarefied atmosphere they were in, and they left. And I heard stories about some of those people who went back to their public schools in Philadelphia or Chicago and did well, went on to good colleges, and as far as I know are doing quite fine. There were other people who got thrown out for social reasons. They either were involved in drinking or getting in enough trouble with the authorities that they were asked to leave. And again, I don't have any sense that the frequency with which that happened was any greater than for white students. A third category, and I think it's the smallest category, failed out. That is, academically, they weren't able to maintain the pace, and they were asked to leave. One of the people I interviewed, who is now a successful newscaster, a television commentator in Washington, D.C., told me how she didn't make it academically at the first school she attended, and the headmaster was very kind. He called her into his office and said, look, this isn't working, but I have a second place to recommend. There's another school that I think would be a better fit for you. She went to that school, finished, went to college, finished, and as I said, is doing well. And I think that story reflects the fact that the schools and often the headmasters or certain teachers or counselors were trying to get this program to work for these kids. They were committed at that point, and they worked hard to have it be a successful experience.
Mm-hmm. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus is Richard Zweigenhaft. He's a professor of psychology at Guilford College and is co-author of a study of the ABC program. That's the initials. It stands for A Better Chance. This was a program that was founded in 1963 to provide young people from disadvantaged backgrounds, minority kids, access to some of the most elite prep schools in the country. And Richard Zweigenhaft is the co-author of a book that examines this program, and he also spent time talking with a number of the graduates to find out what they thought about their experiences and how they did later on in college and in their careers. And the book is entitled Blacks in the White Establishment. If you have questions for us or comments, you can give us a call. Our local number here is 333-9455, and we also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that number is 800-222-9455. We do have a caller on the toll-free line. We'll talk with them right now. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
It's very interesting. I sort of wished I lived in a different era, because that would be an excellent thing. When I was in high school, thought how nice it would be to get involved in one of these rigorous prep schools, because the things at my high school were not particularly interested in those rarefied subjects that you could get into, say, for like in Latin or some other kind of study.
Right.
I was wondering, when he asked some questions that dealt with percentages and stuff, you sort of backed off, and I was wondering if it's because you don't remember the statistical data or perhaps you didn't do it. I'm more interested in how well you channelized all this. First thing came to my mind when you mentioned the word survive, you wanted to make sure they got people who would survive in that more or less rarefied atmosphere. What kind of test did you do, or was it basically subjective judgments, you know, by interviewers? In terms of survival, did you put down such things as, you know, the amount of deaths per 1,000 in particular area and stuff like that?
Right. Let me respond to a number of things that you mentioned. First of all, I assume you're out there in the Midwest. I don't know what area you're living in, but I want to stress that the program started in New England but became a national program. And in the mid to late 60s, they were recruiting in Chicago, in Detroit, in Atlanta, in New York, not too much on the West Coast, though by the end of the, by the late, mid-70s, there were schools and students from the West Coast. In terms of the quality of schools that you mentioned, I want to note one thing. Many of the students that we interviewed came from inner-city schools in cities where things were very rough. They were threatened physically, and they certainly were not stimulated intellectually. A few of the people that we spoke with in describing how much they liked the program referred to what we called academic liberation. That is, they were very pleased to be in a setting where they could pursue things they were interested in without being having to deal with the issues in the halls at their inner city school. And I don't mean to badmouth all inner city schools, but some of the people I spoke with certainly came from some tough places. As for your other question about the kind of research we did, I interviewed 38 graduates of the program, but I did my interviews from about 1986 to 1988 or so. So I was interviewing people who at this time, or at the time of my interviews, were 35, 37 years old, and I was in some depth asking them to think back to what they had experienced. I was fortunate, however, to find some studies that were done in the late 60s, in 1969, again in 1972, which tested these students in some detail using various personality tests like the California Psychological Inventory and various other surveys that the researchers had constructed themselves. Your question about survival, I was really referring, I don't know, metaphorically. None died in the program. I meant to stay in the program and be successful, both academically and in their sense of themselves, their self-image. I do know that the percentage who participated and stayed through the program was over 90% for the first 5 or 6 years. It was probably, by about 1972, still over 80%. And as I said, those figures correspond with the dropout rate for white students at those schools. There's a lengthy footnote in our book where I look at some specific figures from Exeter and question some data that another researcher put forth. But I don't think that's really relevant for us. The real issue, I think my real answer is 80 to 90% stayed in the program. And when I say survived, I mean passed their courses, graduated, and of those who graduated, 99% went on to college. That is, if they finished the program, they were going to college.
Yeah, I'm afraid I was ambiguous. I understood your metaphor. What I actually was after was some way of measuring the environment that each of the students come from, because, as you mentioned, some of those schools in Chicago are pretty rough, and, you know, you certainly couldn't have any Greek Renaissance there, that's for sure. What I meant in terms of survival, were there any particular ways you cut up even the bad background, so to speak, that students who came from perhaps a particularly drug-ridden and, you know, not too much concern about human life, how well they did within the program? Then I spin off my mind right about that is I'd like to see a reversal with those kids who normally go to prep schools, more or less go into that kind of environment and get a, you know, summer's preparation through some sort of session and see how they come out of it, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, let me respond to one thing you raised, because I think there is a good question there. We did look within our sample at which people had done particularly well, and we tried to see if there were variables that were consistent for them to contrast to the people who didn't do so well. And one variable did stand out. I don't think it's the sole issue, but the highly successful participants, the ones who have gone on to be really very successful in their careers, were likely to have either a parent or a grandparent with some higher education or with some emphasis on education. For example, one of the women I interviewed who went on to Harvard and to a successful career in publishing told me that her mother had only finished high school, but had always emphasized books, had encouraged her to read. In fact, her mother had done some teaching at a rural school in the South. One of the people I interviewed in Chicago, in fact, told me that his father had only finished the eighth grade, but he was a voracious reader, one of the smartest men he'd ever known, and his father always emphasized reading. So that was a family background variable. We did not see variables based on the particular schools that they had attended, but we didn't really have too much data on those schools, and we had a relatively small sample to do that kind of a study.
Yeah. Well, I want to get off because there are a lot of other people.
Okay.
I just like to see Bush's choice program turn into something like you're talking about for everybody, because though I understand the importance of the time of the 60s, particularly with the minorities and advancements, I was in Chapel Hill walking the lines back then when stuff started in Greensboro.
Right.
Is that the Appalachia has gotten a very, very poor shake in this country, and it'd be nice to see some sort of program like this, and particularly was impressed by these headmasters taking on that sort of social responsibility.
Right.
I'd like to see something like that begin anew in this country and get things going in, perhaps a really more kinder, gentler direction. Thanks a lot. And
sure, thanks for calling.
Okay, I appreciate the call. We're about midway through our program here, and we have a couple of local callers who are waiting, and we will get right to them in just a moment. Our guest in this hour of focus is Richard Zweigenhaft. He's a professor of psychology at Guilford College, which is located in Greensboro, North Carolina. He is the co-author of a book entitled Blacks in the White Establishment, which is an examination of a program called A Better Chance, which was founded in 1963 to help minority kids succeed in school by placing them in some of the nation's top prep schools. They spent some time talking with a number of people who had been through the program to find out how the experience had been for them and about their success both in universities and in their careers. And if you're interested in taking a look at the book, it's published by the Yale University Press. We have a couple of callers who've been very patiently waiting here. We'll go to them and start with line number one. Hello.
Hello. I have a personal story, a related story that I wanted to tell you about and then ask and see if you had any suggestions or ideas of resources to help out in this situation. I have a brother who lives in Dallas who coaches a couple of black inner-city youth basketball teams. And one of his basketball players is 13 years old and an A-B student in an inner-city school. And through my brother, a prep school is recruiting this student to come to the school. And they're recruiting him because of his basketball abilities, although they will be giving him examinations for entrance and so forth,
right,
academically. But there's no specific program. I mean, this little boy has no, coat or shoes, basically, to socially integrate him into the program. And he'll still be living in the projects but being commuted to this prep school. My question is, are there resources that, maybe national resources or even books other than your book, which I will suggest to my brother, to say if this is a very good idea for the student, or if he could be in a situation that would be basically very damaging by just being thrown into that other world.
Right. Well, the book that I would recommend is called Preparing for Power, America's Elite Boarding Schools. It's a 1985 publication. It's by two NYU sociologists, Peter Cookson, C-O-O-K-S-O-N, and Caroline Purcell, P-E-R-S-E-L-L. I think this book it focuses on elite boarding schools, but has a fair amount of information about other independent schools, and it sounds like this child is being pursued by a day school, not a boarding school, if he'll still be at home.
Right.
There are lots of different kinds of prep schools, and the book I've just mentioned will give you or your brother a sense of the range. I think that there should be some attempt to prepare the child for what will be not only what's likely to be not only a rigorous academic experience, but what can be a difficult social experience. And I think you're focusing on clothes as a good example. I had many students tell me that when they first got to their prep school, the thing that shocked them the most was the wardrobes of the other kids, that they felt self-conscious, and that created some difficulties at the outset, at least. There may be some community resources in Dallas that might help with that very issue. I do know in Greensboro that there are some community agencies that have worked to give nicer clothes to some kids who are attending either local private schools or through our busing program or attending schools where the other kids have fairly flashy wardrobes. And I don't know what exists in Dallas, but I would encourage him to make some contacts in both the educational community. That is, there probably is an organization of independent schools, and they may have some scholarship money that could go to those kind of issues, not just to pay tuition. And there may be community agencies, either through churches or perhaps through political groups that would be willing to sponsor the kid. Those are the ideas that come off the top of my head. I do think that in Cookson and Purcell's book, they will have lots of references for more specific issues, but they may be more academic than you're really interested in for this question anyway.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Well, good luck. I hope it works out.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's go on here. We have someone on our line number two. Hello.
Hello, yes. I was wondering a little bit about extracurricular activities, especially athletics.
Mm-hmm.
Were the minority students able to fit into these sorts of things?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm glad you asked, because I myself am real interested in athletics. During the summer orientation program, the people who set it up specifically attempted to prepare these inner-city kids to be able to participate in sports they had not previously encountered. So they taught them to swim if they didn't know how to swim. They took them rock climbing. They taught them lacrosse, all those preppy sports they might encounter that they hadn't perhaps seen before. And that, I think, to some extent helped. Some people actually got very much involved in those sports. One of the men I interviewed, a graduate of Harvard, a corporate leader in his company, had captained the lacrosse team at Harvard. The issue of athletics was more interesting to me in a second way, and that is that when these kids got to the prep schools, especially for the boys, it was through sports that they often began to either feel comfortable or make some friends. That is, a lot of kids were real homesick, as I've indicated. Some of them were self-conscious about their wardrobe. Some of them had very difficult transitions academically. But they started playing football or basketball or soccer or whatever, you know, whatever sports they were involved in the fall. And that was a very important way to get to know people. And for one thing, it reduced any class differences. If you're rich or poor, if your daddy's rich or your mom's good-looking, it doesn't matter when you're taking a jump shot. The ball's either going to go in or it's not. Or if you can hit a curveball. And so it equalized things in what some psychologists have talked about as equal status settings. And it also meant that they could encounter other students and see what they were like as people and whether they played fair, whether they were good sports. So athletics turned out to be real important for the guys. A number of them, of the people I interviewed, told me they were still in touch with sports buddies from prep school. The women did not stress sports nearly as much, though a couple did tell me they were kind of surprised that they liked some of these sports they had never heard of before. But so that's a two-part answer to your question about athletics.
Yeah, to me, athletics is a great leveler, like you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, social class differences just evaporate, and I think this is one of its great values.
Yeah, I do too. In fact, one of the people we quote in the book is Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who I did not interview, but in his biography, autobiography, Giant Steps, he talks about transferring to a school in Philadelphia and taking a lot of grief from the other kids because he was such a good reader. He was real, real capable academically, and that was not very acceptable. However, because he was such a good athlete, he was able to transcend those pressures from other kids and made friends and gained respect through athletics.
Well, thanks very much for your comment.
Oh, well, thanks
All
for
right.
calling.
Thank you for the call. I wanted to ask you further about ways in which you think the experience for these young people changed them. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at one passage here in the book where you're talking about how they were changed by the experience. And, mm-hmm. and you write something to the effect that the students were not the same people when they graduated they had been when they arrived. Not only were they older and were the recipients of a very, very good education, but you write most had adopted the styles that prevailed in their schools. They dressed like prep school students. They liked the music prep school students liked.
Right.
And they spoke like prep school students. They bear witness to how rapidly the much-vaunted upper-class style can be acquired. And a passage like that, I suppose it makes one wonder at what level these people had been changed. And, you know, things like that are in a sense, rather superficial. Do you feel that there were, in these young people, changes at a much more deeper, fundamental level of them, of who they were as people?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think to some extent, yes, although the key question you're moving toward and is highlighted by the subtitle of our book, A Study of Race and Class in America, is did they remain black? Did they think of themselves as black? Was their identity still very much based on their consciousness as black? And my answer to those questions is yes, but let me elaborate a bit. I think they were changed especially in terms of the options that had opened up for them. These kids were bright, and even if they had not gone to these prep schools, many of them, perhaps most of them, would have done well, and I think were likely to be successful at some level. But I think, for instance, I'll give one example. One of the guys I interviewed in Chicago, I interviewed him in Washington. He had grown up in Chicago. Went on to the St. George's School, went on to Harvard, became a writer for Newsweek. His name's Sylvester Monroe. He's written some very, very fine stuff, including some material about this program. I think Sylvester Monroe would have been a success had he not gone to the St. George's School. But he made it very clear to me in my interview with him that had he stayed in his inner city school in Chicago, he would have run some risks. He was a member of a gang. Some of his good buddies who were also smart ran into big trouble, and he knew that the odds were that he might have run into trouble. Even if he didn't, I think he would have been more likely to go to the state school, to the University of Illinois, and I think around the country, many of these people would have stayed in their region rather than, as was the case, being recruited by Ivy League schools and many other fine schools. So the style stuff, I think you're right, was superficial. The consciousness of self, I think the deeper issue was many people began to realize they could do lots of different things, and they might be able to do those things anywhere in the world, not just anywhere in the country. The possibilities that opened up for them were quite substantial, and they became aware of it. They didn't, however, and this goes back to what I took to be your key question, they didn't become in any way less black. In fact, some people told me they became more conscious of their racial identity. One person, for instance, said that when she was in high school or in a junior high school in Richmond, she was in a black neighborhood. She went to a school that was completely black. She never thought about her race because everybody around her was black, and it just wasn't an issue. She went off to a prep school, and she was one of four black students, and she became much more aware of herself as a black. Her racial identity was, in a sense, heightened. And a few people made that point, that they became more militant at times, certainly more conscious of race. When we traced their experiences later in their lives, it turned out that very few married non-blacks. Most of these people married black partners if they got married. And many of those we interviewed are still very much involved in working in the black community. So they may have a style that reflects their having gone to an elite prep school. They may use the language as preppies do or dress as preppies now 40 years old do. But a lot of them are real involved and committed in the black community. I like to refer to someone else we cite in the book who I didn't interview. I didn't interview Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, but I quoted him, and I didn't interview Tracy Chapman, but we do quote an article about her. Tracy Chapman, the singer-songwriter, was an ABC student at a prep school in New England, and the lyrics of her songs make it very clear that her racial consciousness and her class consciousness of her own class background are still very salient to her. So that's a long answer to your good question.
Well, it's something else that it also makes me think about, a point that I think is worth making that emerges from the book. When you start thinking about why these students did so well, and asking perhaps the question, why is it that they did well? Certainly you have to acknowledge the fact that they did receive top-notch educations. But there seems to be something more than that to it. And that it seems that part of what they got was a psychological determination to succeed, partly because they felt they had worked hard and they knew it, but also because they, I think, were initiated, in a sense, into a social class that feels success is a kind of inheritance. And interestingly enough, I think they view it both as a gift and a burden. But it's something that comes to them because of where they are born, maybe sometimes more than who they are.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a whole bunch of things came together to combine to answer the question why they did well. I think you're right, the top-notch education was a factor, but certainly not the only factor. And their determination to succeed, I think, was a factor, and was a factor that preceded their arrival at the prep schools. I think it was likely to be enhanced at those prep schools because, as you point out, part of the dominant ethos is to do well. And if you're a student at these schools, you are expected to work hard, to do well, and to apply yourselves. I think the concept of networks is worth noting. That is, these people would have done well, as I've said, even if they didn't go through the program, but going through the program, making the friends that they made, going on to very fine schools, making the friends that they made there, they actually not only moved on to an academic fast track, but they moved in circles where they had potentially useful connections. And there are some cases in my interviews where people made it clear that they were able to draw on these networks, either because they were graduates of Hotchkiss or Choate, or because they knew specific people from Hotchkiss or Choate, and that was able to get their foot in the door. You mentioned the initiation process. I do think that the prep school rite of passage is a type of initiation, and I think there was a particular type of initiation for these students who were moving from one background to a very different one. And I want to stress on that point, that transition took some time, and for some people it was very difficult. Our conclusion was that they weathered the adolescent storms quite well, though some people I know had more difficulty than others.
We have a little bit less than 10 minutes left. I'd just like to reintroduce our guest for this morning. We're speaking with Richard Zweigenhaft. He's a professor of psychology at Guilford College, which is in Greensboro, North Carolina, and is the co-author of a book entitled Blacks in the White Establishment, which is about a program called A Better Chance, which was founded in the early 60s to help minority students enter some of the country's most prestigious prep schools. And the authors of the study had an opportunity to talk with some of these people about how the experience was and how their later lives and careers went. If you have questions for us, you can give us a call. I mentioned at the beginning of the program that one of the things that you were very much interested in is trying to get a better understanding about the relative importance of race and class. And in fact, that's the subtitle of the book. And it seems that another strong point that I really want to make sure that we make is that it seems that an upper-class education, an upper-class style can help a minority person succeed in society, and yet one still has to acknowledge the fact that they do meet with and have to deal with a lot of racism, and that it presents real barriers that are still there that simply have to do with the fact that person is a person of color, and that the other advantages, while they may be advantages, maybe not enough.
Right. Well, in fact, late in the book, we pretty much move chronologically through the experiences that these people had. Late in the book, we have a chapter on their experiences in the corporate world. And it was at that point in the interview that many people began to express their frustration. Some people said quite clearly that they experienced very few problems at their prep school, some problems in their college experiences, but especially as they had moved up the corporate ladder in very large corporations, the fact that they were different, even though in fact they were very similar educationally and in some ways, they felt worked against them. And sometimes it was subtle, sometimes it was overt. We actually put a question mark after the word establishment in our title. I'm not quite sure whether it needs to be pronounced with that question mark, but it's not a colon between our title and our subtitle, and that was a conscious choice on our part. The question still remains, as far as we're concerned, about whether blacks will make it in the white establishment. Certainly the people we've interviewed have had a very positive experience. They've done well, but they have been stymied as they've moved toward the top in ways that corresponding groups of whites might not have been stymied. So we call it blacks in the white establishment with a question mark there. Yeah. The other point I want to make in response to this issue is it has to do with how we got into this in the first place. My co-author and I wrote a book that came out in 1982 called Jews in the Protestant Establishment. And in that book, we had interviewed men, in a few cases women, who were Jewish and who were on the boards of directors of Fortune 500 level corporations. They were very successful corporate business people, and we were interested in the same issue, ethnicity and class. What happens if you're Jewish and you start moving in predominantly WASP circles? And we found in that book that the longer a person's family had been in the corporate elite, the more second generation as opposed to first, third generation as opposed to second, the less likely was that person to be involved in being Jewish. To put it another way, they were more likely to have married a Gentile, their kids were more likely to have married out, their kids were less likely to have been bar mitzvah, they were less likely to have gone to Israel. That is, that issue of identity, the answer in that study was they became less Jewish. And we went into this book thinking, well, we're going to ask some of the same questions, but this time we're talking about race, not ethnicity. We're talking about blacks, not Jews. Will we find the same patterns? And the answer is no. We, on that key issue, we did not find the same pattern. And the answer is because of what we found at those highest levels. That is, well, it's more complex than that, but in general, I would say the issue of race, as we see it, has remained more salient. Class is still important, but race has become more salient for the black group than it was for the Jewish group.
Mm-hmm. Before we end up running out of time, unfortunately, we just have a couple of minutes left. Sure. I do also want to have you say a couple of things about how the ABC program has changed, because it is really not the program that it was in the 60s and 70s, and perhaps at least in part because it sounds as if they have much less money to work with. They're getting less government money, and perhaps the foundations aren't quite as generous, and so the ABC folks just don't have the kind of scholarship money that they once had, and it's really changed the nature of the program.
Well, that's true. The program is still functioning, but as you indicate, they have fewer funds to deal with, and that in itself has made a tremendous difference. At the time, the people I interviewed attended these prep schools. When they were accepted, the ABC program was able to say to the school, if you accept this kid at Hotchkiss or Andover or Choate, we will pay half his or her tuition. At one point, they were even able to pay two-thirds. That was a real incentive to the schools, who they wanted capable black students anyway, and then to have ABC say, we'll find them and we'll help pay for them, was a real boon. By 1984, funds had gotten tight enough so that ABC reluctantly had to announce to the schools they could no longer pay any. They were down to 15, 20%, maybe 10%. And so for the last 7 years or so, ABC has functioned mostly as a service for finding students for the prep schools. Well, that's not nearly as big a carrot for those schools, and the schools themselves have developed their own networks, have developed their own scholarship programs, so the ABC program is not as centrally involved at the prep schools as it was in the late 60s. Now, our emphasis in the book is on those early years, and we have not done a careful study of how effective the program is now. The story is even more complicated because the program has gone through not only changes in funding, but changes in leadership, changes in staff, and the population, I think, has shifted in terms of its the options available to it. So that's a quick summary of the ABC program now.
Yeah. Just in about 30 seconds, I'm sorry to have to do that to you.
Okay.
What sort of thoughts does it give you about the nature of education in this country? I mean, what does it tell us about that, do you think, and its relationship to people's success or failure?
Right. Well, first thing it tells me is that the educational process can work quite well if people are able to invest the kind of commitment, the kind of care, and the kind of economic resources that went into this program and into the prep schools. Now, the education problems in the country are, of course, much more extensive and go far beyond the needs of private schools. Second part of your question, I think it's quite clear that a solid education is invaluable in this culture in later success in life. It doesn't guarantee it, and people can succeed without a good education, but it certainly gives one a major foot up. The image that Cookson and Purcell use in that book I talked about, Preparing for Power, they use the term a booster shot. That's like a booster shot for success, to have a good education from a good school.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us this morning.
Well, thanks for having me.
Our guest this morning, Richard Zweigenhaft, is the co-author of a book that we've been talking about, and if you're interested in taking a look at it, the title is Blacks in the White Establishment, A Study of Race and Class in America, and the publisher is the Yale University Press.